Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
My name is Philip Blanco. I come from Sir Isaac Newton's home country, England, as I'm sure you can probably tell. I'm now a lecturer in physics and astronomy at Grossmont College out in El Cajon. I also have my son with me today, Christian, and he's going to be standing in. He's the stunt kid, and he'll be doing a couple of the demonstrations, since you'll be doing them not with other adults, but with other kids. My plan is we're going to look at Newton's laws of motion. There's an idealized depiction of the man himself. We'll go through the three Newton's laws of motion that I'm sure many of you know, but knowing something and being able to impart it and get deep understanding in our students is a lot of effort. So we'll see what the common pitfalls are, and then we're going to apply those to the law of gravity. So here's from Newton's Principia, which is his major work, and he makes a statement that for anybody else would be extremely arrogant. And he says, "I derive from the celestial phenomena the forces of gravity with which bodies tend to the sun and the several planets. Then from these forces, by other propositions, which are also mathematical, I deduce the motions of the planets, the comets, the moon, and the sea." Kind of a tall order, but he was able to do it. So we're going to look at the motion, first of all, of everyday objects, and then eventually celestial objects, by using Newton's laws of motion. But let's have some warm-up questions first. Now, I have a special response method so that we can gauge, even though there's a small group of you, we can gauge your answers. I call it the Classroom Activity Response Device, otherwise known as a CARD. I'll give you a question. I will read it out to you. I generally don't read the choices to students. And then I ask them, think about the answer. Don't fold it prematurely. Don't wave your answer around. Then I'll ask them to fold your card to display the answer. So if the correct answer is D, for instance, I'll have them fold their card like this. And then and only then, I say, please vote. And then I require the students to hold the answer up to their chest. So the nice thing about this is that it's fast, it's easy, doesn't require setup. All you have to do is print and fold these silly cards. So if you see an object moving with constant speed and direction, you know that it must have what? I'd like you to think about the answer, and please vote. So at this point, I ask my students, you guys need to talk to your neighbor about what answer you chose and why you chose it. So even if you agree, you need to come up with a reasoning. So I'll give you 15 seconds to do that. Go. All right, let's see if we learned anything. A lot of you got it right, but not everyone. Please vote again. So we'll see that if something's moving in a constant speed and direction, that D is the correct answer. It doesn't mean there's no force acting on it, just that there's no net force. There's a lot of confusion between no force, meaning nothing, and no net force, that tiny little word. I'll give you a preview of the answer. If you're driving along on the freeway at a constant speed, you've got the radio playing and the cruise control on, there are plenty of forces acting on the car. There's the force of the engine pushing it forwards. There's a very large force of air resistance, which is trying to slow you down. There's the force of gravity trying to pull the car to the center of the Earth. And there's a force acting upwards on the car from the road, trying to hold it up. But all those forces, if you're going at constant velocity, neither speeding up nor slowing down nor changing direction, all those forces will be in balance, so there'll be no net force. All right, next question. Neglecting air drag, a heavy ball and a light ball both fall at the same rate. They memorize that. But why? Excellent. Complete disagreement, so we're all in the right place. I'm going to hold off on the discussion of that one in the interest of time until we look at the relationship between acceleration and force later on. Next question. Astronauts feel weightless in Earth orbit because, and again, we're trying to get at causative reasons for things here. All right, roughly 50-50. Again, we'll come back to these answers. Two more. These are a little easier. If you take a box of candy from the Earth to the Moon, something happens to its mass, possibly, and something happens to its weight, possibly. So this is one of those compound questions. I'd like you to look at the options. Its mass increases and its weight decreases. Its mass increases while the weight stays the same. The mass stays the same while the weight decreases. Or D, the mass stays the same and the weight stays the same. Nothing changes. I'd like you to think about your options and please vote. All right. You've all got it right. Excellent. Finally, the gravitational pull of the Earth on the Sun, something of great interest to Newton and his contemporaries, is related how to the pull of the Sun on the Earth? Is it A, stronger than, B, equal to, C, weaker than, C, in the same direction, D, in the same direction as? Again, some disagreement. And you're not the only ones that would have some uncertainty about this question. Of course, the Sun's very big, very massive. The Earth is comparatively only about a millionth as massive. That's why the Earth is flung around the Sun. But we'll see, in fact, I'll give you the answer this time. The correct answer is B. The forces are equal and opposite. And I'm sure you know which of Newton's laws tell us that. So we use a lot of words in common English that need to be better defined, because before we can talk about how forces affect motion, we need to describe motion. The technical name for this is kinematics. But in everyday speech, there's a lot of confusion and ambiguity. So we need to understand speed, velocity, and acceleration, how they are related and yet how they're different. We'll see how forces are related to motion. We'll look at the difference between mass and weight. We'll learn how gravity keeps the moon and planet in our orbits. We'll talk about what we really mean when we say astronauts are in zero gravity. And we'll see, if you go to different places in our universe, how that affects the force of gravity acting on you and on other things. So this is mainly review for you guys, but it's important to define these things in a very specific way for your students. So your speed, well, that's straightforward. It's your instantaneous rate of change of distance with time, and we measure it in metric units. Velocity is something a little bit more specific. It says your speed in a certain direction. So for instance, let's imagine we have a car that is traveling eastwards, and I can represent how that car is moving. I can represent its direction by an arrow, and I can represent, use the length of the arrow to represent how fast it's going. The arrow is a vector, and we'll have it move at something reasonable, 10 meters per second. I can take another car that's also moving at 10 meters per second. But it's moving at 10 meters per second this way. Do both of these cars have the same speed? Yes, they do. Do they both have the same velocity? No way. All right, so that's how, it's a slow explanation, but that's how you can help students distinguish between the two. Then we come to acceleration, an often abused word. In physics, acceleration means any change in an object's motion. So if it changes its speed by speeding up or slowing down, we call that an acceleration. I'm very careful never to use the term deceleration in front of my students ever, because it sounds like it's a different thing. In terms of the forces acting on objects and their effects, speeding up and slowing down are just different manifestations of the same thing. A change in direction is an acceleration as well. Don't often think of that as accelerating, but if you're driving around a curve at a constant speed, that's an acceleration too. Or, of course, you can do both. And since it's measured as a rate of change, it's measured in meters per second, and since we physicists are too lazy to write two slashes, we'll frequently write it in this confusing form, meters per second squared. Unfortunately, it is confusing because nothing is actually being squared. And I have to tell my college students over and over, you don't have to square anything. It's all right. So from these definitions pops out the logical opposite. Constant velocity, anything that is moving with constant speed and direction, has zero acceleration. So other than standing still, it's about the next simplest thing an object can do. Just move along in a straight line, cruising along at a constant speed. But it took until the time of Galileo for us to recognize the importance of this kind of motion. In fact, Galileo was the first one to write down this definition. He called it uniform motion. And we'll see that that's special, because if you see something moving with a constant velocity, that tells you something very special about the forces that are acting on it. So here's just a picture showing some examples of acceleration: a car speeding up, a car slowing down, or one turning a corner. And if you want to know if you're accelerating, then just take a cup of a hot beverage, like some coffee, and don't be a coward. You don't need one of those lids. and just have that with you in the car. And if you can drink your beverage safely, or in an airplane as well, if you can drink that beverage safely without spilling it all over yourself, then you are not accelerating. You're moving at constant velocity. Any disturbance to that beverage tells you that there's some kind of an acceleration going on. So acceleration is not speed. Now, Newton ran with Galileo's insight into this concept of constant velocity. He looked at the conditions under which it occurred, and he basically adopted Galileo's principle of inertia. Newton thought this so important that this became his first law of motion. And it says, roughly translated from Latin, an object will remain at rest or move with constant velocity unless acted upon by a net external force. And your students will come into the classroom not being empty vessels, as I'm sure you all know. They will have these notions in their mind about what makes objects go and why objects stop going after a while. So Aristotle said that objects tend towards a state of rest, that they like to go back to their natural resting place. And Aristotle's example was that of an archer who's trying to fire an arrow as far as possible. And he said no matter how hard the archer pulls back on the bow, when the archer lets go, the arrow will fly through the air, but that arrow is doomed to return back to its natural state of rest on the earth at some point. And we know in more common experience, if you take something and give it a push, so here's a 1 kilogram mass, if I give it a push along the table, it seems to stop, it seems to return to its natural state of rest. And we know that's true for pretty much everything. I can take this puck-like thing, and give it a push, and it slows down. Galileo and eventually Newton realized that this was for a very different reason, though. It wasn't anything to do with natural states of rest or an object running out of impetus. They realized it was due to a force acting on the object. So if you remove the force, then an object should not go to a state of rest. It should continue a constant velocity in a straight line. Now, this little toy puck happens to come with a motor and a fan, which is kind of loud. But the advantage of that is that it allows the puck to hover around with very little friction. So if I give it the same push as I did before, we'll give it plenty of room to move along, then this puck should obey Newton's first law. There we go. Until acted on by a net external force. This will go all the way along the whole length of the classroom and all the way back again, just with a tiny push. Again, with the motor off, you'll have to trust me, giving it the same push, it barely moves. But you can hear the external force acting on it. If you hear a scraping noise like that, that tells you friction is opposing the motion. So we have lots of examples here. On Earth, things slow down due to friction, but in empty space, we've been able to test Newton's first law. If I give a push to an object or a fellow astronaut in empty space, they're going to just keep on going and going. Now, there are plenty of things that keep on going and going for a while in our common experience. If you're driving a car or flying in a plane at constant speed, then there are plenty of forces acting, as I already mentioned, but there can still be no net external force. In other words, all the forces tend to balance out. Let me give you the example of an airplane. So I'll take suggestions from you. Perhaps you should take suggestions from your students. What forces are acting on this aircraft? Can you name one force that's acting on this airplane as it goes through the air? Lift. Okay, so there's a force acting, and the direction of the force, because it's a vector, so we need to specify the force and its direction, upwards. All right, so we have a lift force acting upwards. I'll represent that with an arrow. We'll call it F lift. And if that were the only force acting on the aircraft, then much like a helicopter, it would be accelerating upwards or like an elevator. So what's another force that's acting on this airplane?
Drag.
Okay, and if the airplane's moving to the right, which direction is drag acting? That way. All right. So drag is something that, of course, we try to reduce, F drag. So there must be other forces acting, because if these were the only two, this aircraft would accelerate up and to the left in this case. Thrust. All right. Or some kind of propulsive force. Here's a question I would want you to ask your students before drawing this or before telling them. How long should I draw the arrow for thrust? If something is flying at constant speed, and this will be surprising to your students, if it's flying at constant speed, then the thrust force, F thrust, will balance the drag force. We don't need to overcome them. We just need to balance those forces. Got one more force that's missing. I thought it would have been the first one that you would have mentioned. Gravity. That's right. F. G. And we'll see that that is related to the mass of the airplane. In fact, and how long should I draw the force of gravity? Should I draw it longer, shorter, or the same as the lift force? It's balanced by the lift force. If we're flying along straight and level, then these forces balance out. Hence, no net force, hence Newton's first law. Just because of that little word, the net external force, doesn't mean you have to have no force. It means as long as the forces are in balance, you'll have things going at a constant velocity. Let's see, other examples. If you're braking in a car, the brakes slow the car down, but you have a choice as to what slows you down. And your choices are, number one, the seatbelt, or number two, the windshield. And I think I would go with the seatbelt every time. Finally, you notice I'm spending a long time on Newton's first law because you've got to get it right. Newton's first law tells us something really important. If you ever see something that's not moving at constant velocity, it's because there is a force. So Newton's first law opens up a universe of forces, and we can start looking for forces that change motion. Because this is the message that will work from kindergarten all the way up through college. Forces change motion. They're not required for motion to be in place, but if there's a change in motion, there must be a net external force. So if that's one thing that your students remember, even if they don't want to do science ever again, forces change motion. Three simple words. So forces are agents of change. And so now we can start looking for forces whenever we see the motion of something change. When you drop something, there must be a force of gravity. We have the force of friction that causes objects to slow down. And again, remove all the forces, we get back to Newton's first law. Now, to try to understand how forces change motion, there are various ways of trying to demonstrate this. I think a good one is to send the students off to the grocery store. Get hold of a shopping cart. You'll find that as you increase the mass of the contents of the cart, for the same change in motion requires more force. If you have more mass, you need to have more force. So the force that you have to supply is proportional to, and some of you I know are teaching students calculus-based physics, proportional to the mass of the object, proportional to the change in velocity, delta V, delta being the mathematical symbol meaning a change in, and also proportional to 1 over the time to effect that change. You put all that together, we find, as Newton realized, that force is proportional to something to do with the mass of the object times how big the change in motion was, divided by the time taken. But this last part, change in motion divided by time, is just the acceleration. Newton's second law, force equals mass times acceleration. Quick review. If there's no net force on an object, we have four possible statements, including the catch-all of both B and C. I'm going to go back a little bit. Let's answer these. First question, if a planet travels in a circular orbit without speeding up or slowing down, is that planet accelerating? A for yes, B for no. So we're all agreed that it's accelerating. The next question, so if we've got the same planet traveling in a circular orbit around the sun, is speeding up or slowing down, must it have a force acting on it? That's right. If there's an acceleration, there must be a force. So already we know something about orbital motion. If we see even planets moving in a circle, we should look for a force that is changing that motion. Before Newton's time, there was a lot of confusion as to what caused the planets to go around the sun. Very easy question for your students. What can produce an acceleration in a car? I do not like to give these questions where all of the above is the answer, but this happens to be the case. So now we're ready to look at Newton's second law. I've chosen the way to represent Newton's second law very carefully here based on experience. I'm sure you all remember learning F equals ma, and that's what students tend to remember. I prefer to say it and to write Newton's second law in a different way. The acceleration of an object, the change in motion, is equal to the net force applied to it, divided by its mass, and is in the direction of the force. So what I said algebraically becomes A equals F net, the net external force, divided by mass. And you might say, well, I can rearrange an equation. It's the same as F net equals MA. But there's a big conceptual difference. So conceptually, A equals F net over M is quite different. It says, here's the effect. forces are the cause of that effect, and the mass, I guess, reduces the effect. If you increase an object's mass, the larger an object's mass, it tells you the larger force is required for the same change in motion. So in this case, it covers all. You cover all the bases to do with forces that balance, forces that cancel out. Remember, you can have a very large force acting on something with no change in motion at all, because there's a very large force acting in the opposite direction, balancing it out. So there is a difference, if you meditate on it, between this version and the one that's commonly taught, where they're taught to look at an acceleration and say, well, there's the force. Often another conceptual mistake is they'll look at the acceleration of an object, multiply it by its mass, and say there is a force called the net force that exists independent of all other forces. It's not how it works. Accelerations do not cause or beget forces. It's the other way around. So I prefer to represent it this way. So we learn from this that force is measured in units of mass times acceleration, and the units are kilogram meters per second squared. But the real unit of force is often written as the newton, in honor of Sir Isaac himself. One newton is equal to 1 kilogram meter per second squared. So now we know a little about forces, and we know about changes in motion. It explains a lot of things. For instance, if you were given a choice of stopping something, and your choice of object or situation was a 60-mile-an-hour baseball or a 6-mile-an-hour linebacker lumbering towards you, or perhaps a train moving very slowly in a shunting yard at 0.6 miles per hour, which do you think you'd have the best chance of stopping? Probably the baseball, even though the baseball is traveling 100 times faster than the freight train. For the linebacker, you'd slow them down a bit. It'd be a bit of a speed bump. And for the freight train, you'd just be hanging on to it as it continues moving at pretty much the same speed. The difference between those objects is, of course, their masses. So mass is a measure of inertia, the resistance, if you like, to changes in motion. And I do have a couple of examples of that. There's a fairly common trick that magicians do, or people do to impress people at parties, called the tablecloth trick, where you have an entire place setting on top of a tablecloth. If you pull the tablecloth away rapidly, the place setting stays in place. I've never got that to work, so here's my small, cheap version with a cup and a glossy postcard, and a little bottle which I can choose to either fill with liquid or leave empty. And if I put the bottle on top of the card, of course I can slide it back and forth. I'm not sliding the bottle directly. I'm moving the card, and it's the friction between the card and the bottle that causes it to move. But because of the inertia of the bottle and the liquid in the bottle, if I flick the card out rapidly enough, there's not enough time for the force to act. And so if I do this right, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, the card should fly out, and the little bottle should just fall vertically down into the cup. There we go. So anything with mass has inertia, by the way. So in fact, mass is a measure of inertia. Let's have a thought question. In this situation, we have a hockey player of mass 100 kilograms with all his kit colliding with a 50-kilogram figure skater. So here we have a couple of questions. Let's just limit ourselves to the first one. Who experiences the greater force of impact? And I'll give you four options, but we won't bother with A, B, C, D. The hockey player, the skater, both the same, or it depends, for instance, on whether he skates into her or whether she skates into him. There's a related question to this, and the answers are the same. Which experiences the greater pull of gravity, the Earth or the Moon? Which experiences the greater change in motion? Turns out the answer to that question is the same as the answer to the hockey player skater question. So let's ask the second question. This is a little bit easier. Your students will find this easier as well. Who experiences the greater change in motion after the collision? Just run the movie in your head. So we have our same choices: hockey player, skater, who's on a diet, only has half the mass of the hockey player, both the same, and it depends. Most of us can agree that the skater is going to come off much worse in this collision. But the answer to the first question is a surprising one, certainly to your students, but the answer is given to us by Newton's third law, often called the law of action and reaction. Very confusing wording. But it says, the standard translation is, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And we see examples of this everywhere. Recoil of a handgun, balls on a pool table. This is how rockets propel themselves. And it's also how you propel yourselves too. We all got here today thanks to Newton's third law of action and reaction. It's much better to say, to translate this, as the force of one object on another, the force of A on B, is equal to the opposite force of B on A. This is true for any force. It says that forces arise in pairs. It also tells us that from the third law, it's impossible for one object to exert a force on another without itself being affected. So the force of the hockey player on the skater is equal and opposite to the force of the skater back on the hockey player. But if the masses are different, then the effects of those forces can be different. And it's important to decouple cause and effect. And I'll try to show you some examples of Newton's third law. So first of all, we don't always think about the equal and opposite force, but it's always there. So for instance, if you were to push a heavy object, so I'm going to push on this table, and it doesn't matter what object I push on, and I'm just going to put a balloon between my hand and the table. So this balloon is going to be a force visualization device. And you can tell how strongly I'm pushing or how gently I'm pushing on this table. You can also tell in which direction I'm pushing. I'm pushing to your right. But I hope you can see that as I push harder to the right, squishing the left-hand side of the balloon, you can see that the opposite side of the balloon squishes in the other direction. And you can see there's no delay. It's not even correct to call it a reaction force because both of these forces are in perfect sync with each other. The harder I push on the table, the harder the table pushes back on me. And if you're using algebraic notation with higher grades, the force of A on B I write as FAB. And then to find the equal and opposite force, you just flip the subscripts around, put a minus sign in there. Gets around a lot of confusion when you do that. So Newton's third law is all about interaction. And this is the hardest law to teach. It says forces always occur in action-reaction pairs. There are a couple of caveats that students often forget, though, that are very important. First of all, the action and reaction forces always act on different objects. In fact, we'll see there's no way you can exert a net external force on yourself. And the action and reaction pairs must be of the same type. So here are some random examples that occurred to me. If a person pushes on a fridge with a surface contact force, the fridge pushes back equal and opposite with the same kind of force. Same with playing a game of billiards. If a cue ball strikes the red, there's an equal and opposite force back on the cue ball. In that case, the masses are equal, so the effects of that are equal. It is correct to say that two magnets repel each other. It is not correct to say that one magnet repels another one. Here's a high-speed photograph of a tennis ball being hit by a racket. You can see the tennis ball is almost a hemisphere. It's been squished inwards as its motion is being changed, as a force is acting on it. But you can also see that the racket strings have been pushed backwards by the equal and opposite force. But this is true everywhere. It's true for forces between atoms. It's true for the forces between galaxies as well. There are some pitfalls of Newton's third law that students get confused by. One is that there's always an interaction between two objects. If you're going to change the motion of something, even if they're not touching, so it could be a long-range electrical or gravitational force, objects cannot exert a net external force on themselves. So this gentleman is not going to be able to pick himself up with a plunger. You're not going to be able to pull yourself up by your belt or your bootstraps because you need to exert a force on an external object. The fancy way of saying this is that action-reaction pairs cannot change the motion of a closed system, one that includes both objects. So if you do want to lift yourself off the ground, you'll need something like a metal bar, and in which case, which way do you have to push or pull on the bar in order to go up? You've got to pull down on the bar, so you have to push down in order to go up. So let's test our understanding of Newton's third law and closed systems, whatever they mean. I have a scientist placing a jar of flies onto a scale. The agitated flies start flapping their wings. What happens? A, the scale shows a weight less than the weight of the jar plus the flies together. Or B, the scale's reading is the same as when the flies sat on the bottom. Although the fly is no longer resting on the bottom, the fly has to exert a force downwards with its wings. And so the weight of the fly is now replaced with the force of the air pushing against the bottom of the jar. In a closed system, flies plus jar, the equal and opposite forces will cancel out, and so you're just left with the weight of the system. Another confusing thing about Newton's third law is, and I've heard this from my students, if all forces are equal and opposite, how does anything ever get anywhere? Don't all the forces cancel out? In this case, we've got a horse and a sled, and of course, the horse exerts a force on the sled, and there's an equal and opposite reaction of the sled back on the horse, and those are equal and those are defined to be equal and opposite pairs, according to Newton's third law. But in addition to that, there is a third object participating, which we often forget about. It's the giant planet that the sled and the horse are attached to. And the reason why the horse is able to pull the sled along is that the force of friction, the traction of the horse's hooves, is much greater than the force of friction slowing down the sled. So in terms of the horse-sled system, there is a net external force, and they will accelerate forwards. Finally, as I mentioned, we use Newton's third law all the time. It's not just used by astronauts in rockets. In walking around, if you think about it, the direction in which you push off the ground in order to walk is backwards. In fact, I'll try to draw what that looks like. So in walking forwards, the force of the foot on the ground is backwards like that. It's the equal and opposite reaction of the ground back on the foot, which makes us go forwards. Wheels use the same principle. Now, this is something that we can test courtesy of yet another toy from a local toy store called a flywheel. This flywheel will rotate clockwise when I pull the cord. So when this wheel contacts the ground, when the rubber meets the road, which way is this wheel going to travel? It's going to travel to the right. Okay, so that should happen. But if you look at the direction of the bottom of the wheel, it is pushing against the ground to the left. So if I spin up this wheel and then release it, and it does go quite fast, you may have to catch it, and I spin it up and land it on this loose piece of paper, my prediction is, and you should ask your students always before you do any demonstration, what is your prediction? The prediction is that the paper should fly backwards while the wheel goes forwards. So let's give it a go. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Final example, of course, is an exciting one to do with rocket propulsion. So in the closed system of rockets plus fuel, or rocket plus propellant, if I can pump this up quickly, the equal and opposite forces cancel. But if you're in the rocket, you don't care about what's happening to the fuel. This particular rocket works not by an explosive force, but by an elastic force pushing the air out of the back of the balloon. So there's the force of the balloon on the air acting this way. The equal and opposite reaction to that is the force of the air back on the balloon acting this way. So if I hold up this balloon and let go of the nozzle, in which direction should the balloon accelerate? Initially to the right. I don't have a whole lot of control over the direction. And it's also noisy. So here we go. 3, 2, 1, lift off. All right, even came back to its owner. So every jet aircraft, every propeller aircraft even works by pushing air backwards, and the equal and opposite push goes forwards. The difference is that in empty space, there's nothing to push against. It used to be said that space travel was impossible for that reason. But of course it's possible. If you push the propellant backwards, there must be an equal and opposite reaction that is propelling you forwards. Even today, 400 years on, there are lots of misconceptions about how gravity actually works. Just going through the list of misconceptions about gravity, all of these are the wrongs. So a common one is gravity stops at the top of the atmosphere, that we're in zero gravity as soon as we get into space. Another is that things fall faster because gravity gets stronger closer to the Earth. Another misconception that is contained in some physics books is that gravity gets even stronger if you dig down towards the center of the Earth. Also not true. If you dig down, then there's less of the Earth under you to pull you. And in fact, if you make it to the center of the Earth, you should just be floating around. Light things such as feathers feel less gravity than dense things, and that hang time is real. that certain basketball players can somehow defy gravity and stay airborne longer than others. There's a misconception, much like we talked about with the lift force of an airplane, that somehow objects thrown upwards are eventually overcome by gravity. But in fact, the gravitational force doesn't change no matter how the object is moving, up or down, left or right. And there's confusion between the term weightlessness and zero gravity. And in fact, we'll see that nobody has been in zero gravity, but you can feel weightless when you're in a state of free fall. Now going to misconceptions about the shape of the Earth. Every kindergarten classroom has a globe in it, and every kindergartner is told that the Earth is round. But how do they reconcile that with their experience? They look around and they see the Earth is pretty flat. And they will believe that if you ask them. Moving on from that, the next notion is that the Earth is ball-shaped and people just live on top. It's only until you reach some level of sophistication around, I would guess around fourth or fifth grade, and perhaps even later for some groups, that they realize, yes, the Earth is ball-shaped. And I like to emphasize this, gravity is not a down force. It's much nicer than that. Gravity is a together force. It brings things together. So there's no absolute version of down. At least one of your students will have at least one of these in their heads. If we go to Galileo, Galileo found by experiment that neglecting air resistance, a big caveat, if you drop any object close to the Earth's surface, it will accelerate at a constant rate, about 9.8 meters per second. So he found it didn't depend on the mass of the object. Non-massive things fell at the same rate as massive things. And we can do the experiment right here. Just the cap of a pen. And I guess I should choose something more massive, one of these weight bars, and I'm going to drop them both at the same time, and they should both hit the ground at the same time. 3, 2, 1, go. There we go. So Galileo found that it didn't matter what you threw off a building, they all fall at the same rate. It didn't matter how the object was moving, its horizontal or vertical velocity, its acceleration in the vertical direction was the same. There's a picture of Galileo, and he's looking up at this time-lapse photograph of a feather and an apple both falling. And you can see that, contrary to what you might expect, the feather and the apple are both falling, accelerating at the same rate. So what's special about that picture is that it was taken in a vacuum chamber where there was no air. We can try to reproduce that with a very simple demonstration here in this room, though. Now, instead, we're going to drop a plastic cup and a feather, and we're going to distinguish between hypotheses put forward by two very smart people, Aristotle on the one hand and Galileo on the other. Aristotle would say that the feather feels less gravity, comes from a bird, and the bird has lots of air in it or something. And so the feather will not be affected by gravity as much. Whereas the cup, made out of something to do with the Earth, should fall down rapidly. And if I let go of the feather and the cup, which is going to hit the ground first? The cup. Let's make sure that that's still the case. And you're right. Now, Galileo's explanation for this, and Newton's, is that there is a force of gravity acting on the feather, but also the feather has to push, relative to its weight, has to push a lot of air out of the way. But if we can somehow remove the effects of air resistance, all objects should fall at the same rate. So a clever way of removing air resistance is to just place the feather inside the cup. Now when I let go of the cup, the feather doesn't have to push any air out of the way. We've got two hypotheses. Aristotle says the feather should get left behind. Galileo says they should fall at the same rate. 3, 2, 1, go. How about that? They both accelerated at the same rate, hit the ground at the same time. But let's ask a little bit, and this is a deep conceptual question. Neglecting air resistance, objects close to the Earth's surface fall at the same rate because the correct answer is B. Gravity is special that way. No other force is able to sense the mass of an object. It knows how massive something is, and if there's more mass, it just pulls more strongly. So just because two things fall at the same rate does not mean that the forces are the same. This is a difficult question for students to answer. And because most of my students get this question wrong, I have a slide already made up. If I double the amount of mass by taking two physical science textbooks, if you drop two of them, you've now got twice the mass. But gravity, being sneaky, says, okay, I'm going to pull on them with twice the force. And the net result is the same acceleration, the same ratio of force over mass. For instance, if I were to take this situation and turn it on its side, let's say we have a drag race between a Honda Civic and a Hummer, and both of them start off at the starting line, and both of them cross the finish line at exactly the same time. So both the Hummer and the Civic have the same acceleration. Would you say that they have the same force pushing them? Which has the larger engine force, the Hummer or the Civic? The Hummer obviously has more mass. And yet somehow when we turn this vertically, it becomes incredibly confusing for our students. And this is a universal thing. So the acceleration due to the gravity is the same for everything. We've tested this idea that all objects accelerate at the same rate, not just on Earth. Apollo 15 astronaut Dave Scott, he pulled out a falcon feather that he had stashed in his Velcro pocket of his spacesuit in honor of the spacecraft called the Falcon, and he decided to test Galileo's experiment.
Well, in my left hand I have a feather, in my right hand a hammer. And I guess one of the reasons we got here today was because of a gentleman named Galileo a long time ago who made a rather significant discovery about falling objects in gravity fields. And we thought that where would be a better place to confirm his findings than on the moon. And so we thought we'd try it here for you. The feather happens to be appropriately a falcon feather for our falcon. And I'll drop the two of them here, and hopefully they'll hit the ground at the same time. How about that? Mr. Galileo was correct in his findings.
Very nice piece of impromptu physics. And of course, it's reassuring that Galileo's experiment worked because using Newton's laws of motion based on Galileo's principles of inertia and gravity was necessary to bring those two men and the command module pilot safely back home. So things don't just fall when you let go, of course. You can throw objects up in the air. You can throw them horizontally as well. Galileo found it doesn't matter. Gravity is going to pull these objects towards the center of the Earth. When you throw something up in the air, gravity acts on it all the way up. Gravity does not stop acting just because something stops for an instant. And gravity continues to act all the way down. And as a result of that, if there's no air resistance, if you shoot something or throw something up in the air, it's going to come back down at the same speed. Anything in free fall, or any person in free fall, feels apparently weightless. Of course, gravity is still acting on them, but if all the parts of you are accelerating at the same rate, then you do not feel that gravity. So I prefer to say that you feel weightless rather than you are weightless. And you don't have to go into space in order to feel weightless. Just buy a little trampoline and you can bounce up and down quite happily. Here's a cheerleader being thrown up into the air. I believe this is called a basket toss. She's weightless from the moment she leaves their hands to the moment they catch her. And she's caught here at the top of her motion. I'm going to skip over gravity and Newton's third law, except to answer one of the questions that I posed earlier. If you compare the force of the Earth on the moon with the force of the moon back on the Earth, the forces are equal and opposite, but the effects of those forces are very different. So here's a question for you. You all know that the Earth is pulling down on you. The force of gravity on you is your weight, right? So what is the equal and opposite reaction to your weight? The gravitational force of the Earth on you is equal and opposite to, and again you just switch the objects, the gravitational force of you pulling up on the Earth. Now the Earth is a lot more massive than you are, so if you jump off a table, you're going to accelerate towards the Earth far more than it's going to accelerate up to you. So mass and weight are very different, even though we tend to use the same terms interchangeably. Mass, we've seen, is a measure of inertia, and in fact we compare all masses to a single standard, a standard international kilogram that is kept in Paris, whereas the weight of an object is the force of gravity acting on it. Now unlike mass, weight changes depending on where you are in the universe. In the moon's gravity, you only feel 1/6 of your weight, even though you have the same amount of mass. And on Earth, we often get mass and weight confused because all the bathroom scales that are sold that I know of are for use on the Earth. So we're really comparing weights, but we use the fact that, assuming everything is on the Earth, we can compare masses that way as well. So when astronauts are moving around in a different gravity field, they're able to wear spacesuits which on Earth would be prohibitively heavy. Many of the Apollo astronauts forgot about the inertia side of things. They thought that just because they could lift up a large mass, just because it didn't weigh very much, that it wouldn't have much inertia either. And they frequently, literally, fell foul of that mistake. So I'll show an example here of the second to last person on the moon, a civilian astronaut Jack Schmidt in Apollo 17, picking up an object which on Earth would be quite heavy to pick up. It has a lot of mass. On the moon, it's easy to pick up, but he forgets the fact that it has a lot of inertia.
Jack Schmidt having a few problems.
Here's a little blooper reel of our tax dollars at work, of astronauts once again forgetting that just because something has a small amount of weight doesn't mean it has a small amount of inertia. And they're falling prey to Newton's first law. If you have a large mass that's set in motion, it takes a large force to change the motion of it. The nice thing is that since you don't weigh very much, it just takes a very simple push-up to get yourself back upright again. But there's a definite difference between mass and weight. I want to show you a nice demonstration, which is a nice kinesthetic exercise that your students can do. It's just to emphasize that the gravity that we're in now, here on the Earth, doesn't have to be the same as gravity is everywhere. If you go to different places in our solar system, the force of gravity is different, and you will weigh different amounts. Well, weighing things is kind of interesting, but not that exciting. What is exciting is when the amount of gravity is reduced for a given speed upwards, you can increase the amount of time that you're airborne, and you can also increase the height that you can jump. This still photograph shows Apollo 16 Commander John Young jumping as he salutes the American flag in 1/6 gravity. So first of all, we have Lunar Module pilot Charlie Duke wandering out.
And Tony, the rover tracks are just—they're barely sinking in.
Hey, we can see that.
You can't put it too far down in the middle of the. Hey, John, this is perfect with the limb and the rover and you and Stone Mountain and the old flag. Come on out here and give me a salute. Big Navy salute.
This footage was taken by a remotely operated camera, operated by someone from Earth. The camera is mounted on the lunar rover.
That's a pretty outstanding picture here, I tell you.
Come out a little bit closer. Okay, here we go, a big one. Off the ground, one more. There we go.
Yes.
So imagine trying to jump like that when you have a whole other person on your back. It's fun to see people bouncing around in space, but we could also have people jumping up and down on the Earth as well. And this is where I need my student volunteer, our stunt student, who is going to show us how high you can jump on the Earth, and then we'll use the laws of physics to calculate how high he'll be able to jump on other worlds. I wrote a little program which allows you to explore different gravitational fields and how high people can jump. So, Christian, if you come out to demonstrate, I will use a meter stick. And the first thing I'd like to have your student do, and they can do this in groups as well. This is a lot of fun with younger grades, and it includes some very simple multiplication as well, and also just the ability to measure things. All right, Christian, I'd like you to point with the palm of your hand to the highest point possible on this vertical surface, on this wall. I usually have students make a chalk mark. All right, so I'm going to put a piece of tape right here, so the bottom of the tape is right where his fingertips are. And now I'm going to ask you, you can make a practice jump if you want to wear appropriate footwear, to make a mark, the highest mark you possibly can by jumping. So if you would face the wall, I'd like you to jump as high as you can and make the highest mark possible. All right, off you go. Looked like it was about there. Do you want to try again? About the same, very consistent. All right, thank you very much, Christian. So if we measure the distance, this is how high he jumped. And it's pretty much the same for most kids. It doesn't matter if they're tall or short. Christian was able to jump 19 centimeters on the surface of the Earth. This girl in this animation is about 1.5 meters tall, so she's about the height of a fifth or a sixth grader. And if we enter the jump height in centimeters, 19, we can simulate that jump. So on Earth, if you jump 19 centimeters, you're off the ground for almost 0.4 seconds. And so let's go to Mars, where gravity is 1/3 of what it is on the Earth. And we're going to jump with the same speed. Since gravity is about one-third, you spend a third as long in the air and you go about a third as high. So on Mars, he would be able to jump not 19 centimeters, but about 50 centimeters, about up to here. We go to the moon. So we have the twin sister staying on the Earth for comparison. On the moon, he would be able to jump 114 centimeters, which is about this high. This is where his feet would be. And he would easily be able to spend plenty of time, 2.37 seconds, jumping on the moon. There are some places in the solar system with more gravity than surface gravity than the Earth, though. If you go to Jupiter, the most massive planet, and has no surface, so you have to float around in a balloon on Jupiter, you can see you're not going to spend nearly as much time. In fact, there's even some spinal compression there, because on Jupiter, the surface gravity is about 2.5 times what it is on the Earth. Let's pick another gas giant planet, Saturn. Beautiful Saturn with its rings. If you're floating around in a helium balloon in the atmosphere of Saturn, and you jump up and down, do you think you'll be able to jump as high as you could on Earth, not as high, or higher? It's a big planet. It's got a lot of mass. But it turns out the size of the planet is important as well. Saturn is many hundreds of times the mass of the Earth. But if you're in the atmosphere of Saturn, you are much farther away from the center than you are at the surface of the Earth. So it turns out you'd be quite comfortable. Surface gravity is roughly the same. I'll give you two extreme examples. Uranus and Neptune, fairly similar to the Earth. If you were to go to the Sun, assuming you could survive on the surface, and try to jump on the Sun, I wouldn't recommend it. Because the surface gravity is 30 times. Now, Pluto's included in the list. This is one reason, not the only reason, but one reason why astronomers do not consider Pluto to be a planet anymore. Because if you were to jump with the same speed on the surface of Pluto, you can see the gravity is so small, only 6% of what it is on the Earth, you could jump very high. In fact, his head would be making a hole in the ceiling at this point. There are other objects called asteroids. The largest of the asteroids, of which there are many thousands, is called Ceres, the goddess of wheat. Let's see how high a kid can jump on Ceres. You'd be gone for quite a while. In fact, even if you are standing on the surface of this asteroid in your spacesuit, even if you sneeze by accident, which is not something you want to do in a spacesuit, just the strength of the muscle spasm into your legs and into your feet is going to send you flying. Because of Newton's third law, if you push down on that asteroid, you're going up. In fact, there have been a couple of attempts to land spacecraft on the surface of a couple of asteroids. In one case, they're not sure if it was successful. The spacecraft, a Japanese spacecraft, might have bounced off the surface. So in future, if we want to send robotic spacecraft to asteroids, we have to equip them with some kind of a harpoon-like device. They shoot the harpoon into the surface, and then they can reel themselves in. But they need to reel themselves in quickly because, of course, the act of shooting a harpoon into the surface will cause an equal and opposite reaction, accelerating the spacecraft away. So that's another nice thing you can get your students to think about, a Newton's Law's case study of perhaps asteroid visitation. Just wanted to show you a couple of extra slides that are included in the CD. This is something the Mythbusters tested just a couple of weeks ago. Since all objects fall at the same rate, and since, according to Newton, forces only change the motion in the direction of the force, then an object that is projected horizontally will fall at the same rate as one that is just falling vertically. And we can, so every projectile falls. And we can go from that to looking at how objects move around the Sun. It's gravity that keeps planets going around the Sun, but because the force only changes the motion in the direction of the force, planets aren't pulled into and smashed into the Sun. They are pulled around the Sun. That would be a much more correct way of describing that. In fact, orbiting an object is the act of falling towards it and missing. So I'm trying to popularize this turn of phrase, that planets fall around the Sun, spacecraft fall around the Earth because of the inward gravitational pull. There's one more simulation that makes a nice connection. This is what's called a thought experiment, something that you couldn't do practically, but you can think through the consequences of it. Newton's thought experiment was building an enormous mountain that popped up above the clouds, on which you put a large cannon. If you fire the cannon at a small speed, as you might expect, the cannonball falls towards the ground. If we speed up the horizontal velocity of our cannonball, it falls towards the surface of the Earth, but it goes a little bit farther because the surface of the Earth is curved. If we go faster, I'm sure you can tell what's going to happen. As we increase the speed of the cannonball, it goes further, it goes farther around the Earth, but it's always being pulled in towards the center. And it turns out that there is a special speed just above the Earth's atmosphere of about 8 kilometers per second, where once I fire the cannonball is falling towards the center of the Earth, it's still falling towards the center of the Earth, it's still falling towards the center of the Earth. So this is the connection between falling objects close to the surface of the Earth and orbital motion. And this was Newton's insight and genius. If we increase the speed further, we just get different shaped and larger orbits until we reach a critical speed called the escape velocity. If we shoot something away from the Earth at greater than the escape velocity, it never actually curves around and comes back. But there's still plenty of gravity in space. You can still see that the path of the object is a curved one. In fact, it's a hyperbola for those of you who like geometry. I always like to show students the original source. So this is not from Principia, which is written in Latin, but it's an English version of the book, the coffee table version called Treatise of the System of the Worlds. This is Newton's own diagram of his hypothetical cannon, and you can see the different trajectories. And I always tell my students, and this is Newton's thumb turning the page. So there's plenty of gravity in Earth orbit. If there wasn't, nothing would orbit. Newton's first law would be obeyed and everything would fly off. And if you built a ladder tall enough, you could stand on a bathroom scale and it would read almost the same as it would read on the surface of the Earth. But the astronaut in the space shuttle falling freely past you would feel effectively weightless. And I use the term feel weightless because they still have gravity acting on them. I'm pretty much out of time. Just wanted to share with you a nice vision of the future. It's been a long time since human beings have been back to the moon, or in fact out of Earth orbit. We spend most of our time going around in circles. I think it's up to us to educate and motivate and excite the next generation of explorers. And perhaps if we do so, one day, after we are long gone, perhaps this will be a typical scene of spending a day with your grandchild on the surface of the moon, looking back at the Earth and discussing how Newton's laws apply in both places. So I think I will finish there.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.